This CLE is based on appellate decisions released in the month of November 2019 addressing issues in criminal law. The summaries of these decisions were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in November of 2019, and they've since been compiled in a November 2019 criminal law update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet that serves as the written materials for the CLE, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is on page 6, People versus Smittinger. It has to do with the need for some kind of consideration to make a valid waiver of the right to appeal. The Fourth Department noted that a waiver of appeal to be enforceable must be supported by a sentence promise as consideration. The court said, defendant correctly argues in his main brief that his waiver of the right to appeal is invalid because he pleaded guilty to the sole count of the indictment without receiving a sentencing commitment or any other consideration. County courts promised to consider imposing a sentence below the statutory maximum merely restated its pre-existing statutory and common law obligation to impose an appropriate legal sentence. And we agree with defendant that such a promise is the equivalent of no promise at all and cannot supply the consideration necessary to enforce a waiver of the right to appeal. So the takeaway there is, to be enforceable, a waiver of appeal must be supported by a sentencing commitment or some other consideration. Next is People versus Thomas on pages 6 and 7. Court of Appeals case. It's an important clarification of the law surrounding waivers of appeal. The Court of Appeals, in a comprehensive opinion by Judge DiFiore, over several concurring and two dissenting opinions, held that the waivers of appeal in two of the three appeals before the court were invalid. In a nutshell, a court should not give the defendant the impression that all appellate avenues, including the filing of a notice of appeal, collateral relief, and the availability of appellate counsel, are cut off by the waiver. The Court of Appeals approved the Unified Court System's model colloquy. The court said, the model colloquy for the waiver of right to appeal drafted by the Unified Court System's Criminal Jury Instructions and Model Colloquy Committee neatly synthesizes our precedent and the governing principles and provides a solid reference for better practice. The model colloquy provides a concise statement conveying the distinction missing in most shorthand colloquies, that by waiving your right to appeal, you do not give up your right to take an appeal by filing a notice of appeal within 30 days of the sentence. But if you take an appeal, you are by this waiver giving up the right to have the appellate court consider most claims of error and whether the sentence I impose, whatever it may be, is excessive and should be modified. As a result, the conviction by this plea and sentence will normally be final. That's the New York Model Colloquy's waiver of right to appeal. The court went on, there is no mention made of an absolute bar to the taking of an appeal or any purported waiver of collateral or federal relief in the Model Colloquy or to the complete loss of the right to counsel to prosecute the direct appeal. So the takeaway there is, in order to be valid, a waiver of appeal cannot give the defendant the impression that all avenues of appeal and collateral relief, including access to appellate counsel, are cut off by the waiver. Next is People v. De La Cruz on page 7. It stands for the proposition that there is no crime of attempted gang assault. The First Department, vacating defendant's conviction, held the charged crime was a legal impossibility. The court said, attempted gang assault in the second degree is a legal impossibility for trial purposes. One cannot attempt to create an unintended result. So the takeaway here is there is no crime of attempted gang assault. The De La Cruz case does not explain the reasons underlying this conclusion, and it would take a little research reading the cases that are cited in De La Cruz to figure out the rationale. But the takeaway again is there is no crime of attempted gang assault in the second degree. Next is People versus Abilov on pages 8 and 9. It has to do with the authority of the Attorney General to prosecute, in this case, a district attorney for alleged perjury before a grand jury that was convened by the Attorney General. Third Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Mulvey, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant, a district attorney, could be prosecuted by the Attorney General for perjury allegedly committed by the district attorney before a grand jury convened by the Attorney General. The grand jury was convened to investigate whether the district attorney had engaged in misconduct when investigating the police shooting of an unarmed civilian. The authority of the Attorney General's investigation and indictment is Executive Law 63 and two executive orders issued by Governor Cuomo. The gist of the decision is that it takes both levels of authority to give the Attorney General the power to bring this criminal action against the district attorney. The statutory authority is Executive Law 63, Subdivision 13, and that is combined with orders issued by Governor Cuomo, and the combination of those two sources of authority allowed the Office of the Attorney General to prosecute the district attorney. And the court made clear that simply the statutory authority standing alone or the executive order standing alone would not be sufficient to confer this authority, but in combination they are sufficient. Next is People versus Richards on pages 9 and 10. It's an ineffective assistance case. The court felt that the defendant did not receive effective assistance because the attorney representing him was not aware that he could have worked out a plea without any deportation consequences. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant did not receive effective assistance of counsel because there was a reasonable possibility a plea to something less than an aggravated felony could have been worked out with no mandatory deportation consequences. The court wrote, at the hearing, defense counsel candidly admitted he did not know at the time of defendant's plea what an aggravated felony was, and that he mistakenly believed the defendant's prior youthful offender adjudication, which resulted in a violation of probation charge that was disposed of at the same time as the instant plea, already rendered him deportable. However, New York youthful offender adjudications are not considered criminal convictions for purposes of immigration law. Accordingly, he did not attempt to obtain a sentence of less than 1 year on the third degree conviction, which would have prevented it from being an aggravated felony, subjecting defendant who was in removal proceedings to mandatory deportation. Counsel admitted that he had no strategic reason for not doing so. He simply did not know that defendant's negotiated sentence of 1 to 3 years rendered robbery in the third degree an aggravated felony, or that defendant's youthful offender adjudication did not render him deportable. Next is People v. Johnson on page 10. It's another ineffective assistance case dealing with deportation. First Department, over a dissent, held defendant did not receive effective assistance of counsel because his attorney told him he would most likely be deported when deportation was mandatory. The dissenter argued the record was not sufficient to conclude as a matter of law defense counsel was ineffective and a criminal procedure law 440 motion should be brought to flesh out the facts. The court wrote, the remarks made by counsel on the record to the judge as to what he advised his client with regard to the immigration consequences of his plea are sufficient to permit review on direct appeal. Thus, we hold this matter in abeyance to afford defendant the opportunity to move to vacate his plea upon a showing that there is a reasonable probability that he would not have pleaded guilty had he been made aware of the deportation consequences of his plea. Next is People v. Harris on page 11. It's a right to counsel case, suppression motion. Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held his motion to suppress statements made after the assertion of his right to counsel should have been granted. The court wrote, defendant was advised of and acknowledged his Miranda rights in writing roughly 16 minutes into the custodial interrogation after having made small talk with the detective questioning him. For the next 24 minutes, defendant openly and respectfully answered questions regarding the events that transpired earlier that morning, including whether he entered the apartment building, which he maintained that he did not. 40 minutes into the interview, defendant became increasingly quiet and less eager to engage in conversation. The detective spoke for roughly 3.5 minutes with little to no contribution from defendant, and the detective attempted to appeal to defendant as a father. Defendant asked if he would be at the police station all weekend, to which the detective said no. The detective then asked defendant to tell him what happened, but he was met with silence, prompting him to ask again. In response, defendant stated, maybe I should get a lawyer. I completely understand what you're saying, and I agree with you, but I don't want to fuck myself. In our view, defendant's marked change in expression and demeanor at this stage of the interrogation, together with his reference to an attorney and his clear statement that he did not want to incriminate himself, constituted an unequivocal request for counsel and an exercise of his right to remain silent. Next is Matter of New York Times on page 12. It deals with the criteria for a Freedom of Information Law request, a FOIL request, for records from the District Attorney's Conviction Review Unit, CRU, which exonerates convicted persons. The Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Connolly, held 1. The redacted report of the District Attorney's Conviction Review Unit concerning the exoneration of Jabbar Washington was properly made available to the New York Times because Washington consented to the unsealing of the document, citing Criminal Procedure Law 160.50, subdivisions A and D. 2. Absent such consent, the Conviction Review Unit reports are exempt from disclosure under the Freedom of Information Law. And 3. The redaction of the Washington report should be reviewed by a judge, an in-camera review. So the takeaway here is that the reports by the District Attorney's Conviction Review Unit are not available under the Freedom of Information Law unless the person who is the subject of the report consents to its release. But the released report is subject to redaction, and the redaction should be reviewed by a judge in camera. Next is People v. Hines on page 13. It's an identification case. The court held that the loss prevention officers should not have been allowed to identify the defendant who appeared in the surveillance video at trial. But defense counsel's failure to object to that identification did not rise to the level of ineffective assistance. The Fourth Department held defense counsel's failure to object to testimony of the loss prevention officers identifying defendant in a surveillance video was not demonstrated to amount to ineffective assistance. The court said, although we agree with defendant that there's no basis in the record to conclude that the loss prevention officers who gave testimony identifying defendant as an individual depicted in the surveillance video were more likely to correctly identify the defendant from the video than the jury, we further conclude the defendant failed to demonstrate the absence of strategic or other legitimate explanations for counsel's alleged shortcoming in failing to object to the admission of that testimony. So the testimony was error, but failing to object was not shown to meet the criteria for ineffective assistance. Next is People v. Del Cid on page 13. It deals with the vacation of convictions of inclusory concurrent counts. The Second Department held inclusory concurrent counts must be dismissed and the related convictions and sentences vacated. The court wrote, as charged, the counts alleging driving while ability impaired by alcohol in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law 1192.1 and aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle in the second degree were inclusory concurrent counts of the count alleging aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle in the first degree. And it cites Criminal Procedure Law 300.30 subdivision 4, Criminal Procedure Law section 300.40 subdivision 3b, Vehicle and Traffic Law sections 511.2 subdivision 2 and subdivision 3, and section 1192. Accordingly, the defendant's convictions of driving while ability impaired by alcohol in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law 1192.1 and aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle in the second degree and the sentence imposed thereon must be vacated and those counts of the indictment dismissed. So the takeaway is convictions of inclusory concurrent counts and the sentences on those convictions must be vacated. The criteria for determining what offenses are inclusory concurrent counts would require an analysis of the statutes that were cited here, primarily Criminal Procedure Law 300.30 Subdivision 4 and Criminal Procedure Law 300.40 Subdivision 3b. Next is People v. Mackey on page 14. The court found that the conspiracy counts were fatally flawed because no overt acts were alleged, and the convictions were reversed and the counts were dismissed. The court wrote, the two conspiracy counts neither allege that an overt act was committed nor include factual allegations describing such an act. There's no assertion that defendant took any action beyond agreeing to engage in or cause the performance of a Class B felony. So the takeaway there is an indictment charging conspiracy must be supported by allegations of an overt act. Next is People v. Laura on pages 14 and 15. It deals with what was found to be an abuse of discretion by the judge when the judge refused to consider a response to defendant's motion to dismiss that was 2 weeks late. First Department reversing Supreme Court over a two-justice dissent held the trial judge should not have refused to consider a late response to the defense motion to dismiss on speedy trial grounds. The court said, here the people sought to file their opposition papers on the decision date some 15 days after the due date. There's nothing in the record to suggest that there was any history of dilatory conduct or a blatant disregard of court directives on the part of the people. Rather, this appears to be an isolated lapse. While we are certainly cognizant of the frustration occasioned by the failure of the people to adhere to the motion schedule, summarily granting the defense motion to dismiss without considering the merits of the response the people had prepared was improper. As the people argue, the charges here are serious. Defendant was indicted on numerous weapons possession charges. Dismissal of those charges without a full and complete determination of the motion to dismiss on its merits was unduly harsh. Less drastic remedies, including charging the people for the 15-day delay, were available. Next is People versus Kennedy on pages 15 and 16. It's another case that deals with the impropriety of the actions taken by a judge. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the trial judge should not have limited cross-examination of the prosecution's witness about DNA transfer and should not have instructed the jury during defense counsel's summation to accept the testimony of a prosecution witness. The court wrote, the court's limitation of defense counsel's cross-examination with regard to DNA transfer was an improvident exercise of discretion, since the testimony defense counsel sought to elicit would have been relevant and would not have confused or misled the jury. Moreover, under the circumstances presented, the error was not harmless, as there is a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the defendant's convictions. We also agree with the defendant's contention that his right to a fair trial was violated when, during summation, defense counsel attacked the credibility of the testimony of certain police officers regarding wanted posters, and the Supreme Court instructed the jury, quote, there was testimony on that. The jurors will be bound by its recollection of the testimony and the explanation. Since a jury is presumed to follow the court's instructions, the court's instruction, which bound the jury to accept the officer's explanation rather than to rely on its recollection of the testimony and the evidence, was erroneous. Next is People v. McGregor on pages 16 and 17. It's a case involving juror bias. The First Department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering a new trial, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Renwick, held that a juror who attempted to develop a relationship with a jailed cooperating prosecution witness during deliberations exhibited actual and implied bias, thereby depriving defendant of a fair trial. Although the juror and the witness were not able to speak to each other during deliberations, there was a missed call. After the trial, the juror developed a serious relationship with the witness through letters and phone calls and expressed a desire to marry the witness. The First Department noted that a harmless error analysis was not appropriate. The court wrote, juror misconduct includes both actual bias and implied bias. Despite its name, actual bias merely requires proof of a state of mind that is likely to preclude a juror from rendering an impartial verdict. Under criminal procedure law, section 270.20, 1B, actual bias is not limited to situations where a prospective juror has formed an opinion as to the defendant's guilt. It may be demonstrated where a prospective juror's conduct indicates her inability to follow the court's instructions. Implied bias exists where a juror bears some relationship to any such person, defendant, witness, prosecution, of such nature that it is likely to preclude the juror from rendering an impartial verdict. That's criminal procedure law 270.21c. The frequency of contact and nature of the party's relationship are to be considered in determining whether disqualification is necessary. Implied bias requires automatic exclusion from jury service, regardless of whether the prospective juror declares that the relationship will not affect his or her ability to be fair and impartial. Here, there was both actual and implied bias. Next is People v. Mack on page 17. It's a jury instruction case. Third Department, reversing defendant's possession of a weapon convictions, held the jury should have been instructed on the innocent possession of a weapon defense. Defendant testified the person who had just robbed him dropped the sweatshirt, which had a handgun, in the pocket. According to the defendant's testimony, just as defendant picked up the sweatshirt, the police pulled up. The court wrote, defendant's testimony, if credited, provides sufficient facts from which the jury could find a lawful basis for defendant having temporarily and innocently possessed the subject pistol without having had any intent to use it in a dangerous manner or an opportunity to subsequently turn it over to the police. Next is People v. Assan on page 18. It has to do with the right to a jury trial for a B misdemeanor. The second department reversed defendant's conviction based upon a recent Court of Appeals case, which held a defendant charged with a misdemeanor which carries deportation as a potential penalty is entitled to a jury trial. The court wrote, "The defendant, a non-citizen, is entitled to a jury trial under the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution because the charged crime of attempted assault in the first degree, a Class B misdemeanor, carries a potential penalty of deportation." And it cites People v. Suazo, 32 New York 3rd, 491. Next is matter of Quasi P., a case that came out of the family court, a juvenile delinquency proceeding. The First Department, reversing family court in this juvenile delinquency proceeding, held appellant's mother was not advised of the rights appellant was giving up by admitting to the offense. As the presentment agency concedes, appellant's admission was defective because the court's allocution of appellant's mother failed to advise her of the rights appellant was waiving as a result of his admission and the dispositional consequences of appellant's admission. And that's citing Family Court Act, Section 321.3, Subdivision 1. So the takeaway there is any allocution in family court where an admission is made by a juvenile, the strict requirements for the allocution laid out in Family Court Act, Section 321.3, have to be followed, and that includes informing the parent of the dispositional consequences. Next is People v. Hollander on pages 19 and 20. It's a Molyneux case. Second Department reversing defendant's conviction held that the probative value of evidence submitted to the jury was outweighed by its prejudicial effect. Defendant was charged under the education law with practicing dentistry without a license. Defendant alleged he was legally acting as a clinical director in a dental office. The jury was presented with evidence indicating defendant had previously been accused of practicing dentistry fraudulently. The court wrote, "The references to fraud and moral turpitude were not relevant to the issue of whether the defendant was unlicensed and was aware that he was unlicensed. Under the circumstances, any probative value of the evidence of the prior fraud was outweighed by its prejudicial effect." Next is People v. Stan Zhu Hui Li on page 20. It's a Court of Appeals case dealing with manslaughter arising out of the prescription of opioids. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Fahey over a dissenting opinion, held that the defendant, a pain management doctor, was properly convicted of manslaughter, recklessly causing the death of two persons, Haig and Rapold, to whom defendant prescribed opioids as part of a pill mill operation. Next is People v. Rouse on page 21. It has to do with the cross-examination of police officers about prior acts of dishonesty. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Fahey, reversing defendant's conviction, held the trial court abused its discretion when it denied defense counsel's request to cross-examine the two police witnesses about prior acts of dishonesty. The two officers presented the only evidence which identified the defendant as the shooter in this attempted murder prosecution. The court said, "At the suppression hearing held before trial, the officer's testimony supported defendant's contention that in preparing to testify in an unrelated federal criminal proceeding, he had misled the prosecutor in that case with respect to his involvement in a ticket-fixing scheme. Defense counsel was not permitted to explore what defense counsel characterized as that officer's lies to the federal prosecutor regarding those activities. The court limited exploration of that officer's prior bad acts to his participation in the ticket-fixing scheme and did not permit inquiry with respect to that officer's deceit of the federal prosecutor. That ruling was an abuse of discretion as a matter of law. Next is People v. Cole on pages 21 and 22. The court found that it was error to allow the defendant to be cross-examined about an old burglary conviction because it was too remote in time, but the error was found harmless. Third Department held county court should not have ruled defendant could be cross-examined about a 1991 burglary conviction in this assault, DWI, and reckless driving case arising from a single car accident. The defendant's record had been unblemished for 23 years when he was released from prison. The defendant argued that, but for the Sandoval ruling, he would have testified. The court said, "In gauging whether a conviction is too remote, courts often consider the period of time during which the defendant was incarcerated, as county court did here. For instance, in People v. Wright, 38 A.D. 3rd, page 1004, this court allowed inquiry about 20-year-old rape and robbery convictions where the defendant had been released from prison only 9 months prior to the present offense. By comparison here, the defendant had been released from prison for 23 years with an unblemished record leading up to this event. Under these circumstances, we conclude that county court abused its discretion in allowing inquiry into the 1991 conviction, which was simply too remote." But again, the court found the error harmless in this case. Next is People v. Williams on pages 22 and 23, a search and seizure case. Fourth Department, reversing the relevant convictions, held the police officer effectively seized defendant by blocking defendant's car based on an anonymous tip. The evidence seized from the car should have been suppressed. The court wrote, "The conviction of criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree arises from a police encounter during which an officer received information from an anonymous 911 call that drugs were being sold out of a vehicle. The officer arrived on the scene and observed a legally parked vehicle matching the description given by the anonymous caller, and further observed defendant in a fully reclined position in the driver's seat. The officer parked his patrol car alongside defendant's vehicle in such a manner as to prevent defendant from driving away, and as the people stipulated in their post-hearing memorandum, the officer thereby effectively seized the vehicle. We agree with defendant that the police lacked reasonable suspicion to justify the initial seizure, and thus county court erred in refusing to suppress both the tangible property seized, that being the weapon and marijuana found in the vehicle, and the statements defendant made to the police at the time of his arrest. Based on the anonymous tip and defendant's otherwise innocuous behavior, the officer had at most a founded suspicion that criminal activity was afoot, which permitted him to approach the vehicle and make a common law inquiry of its occupants. The officer did not make any confirmatory observations of the criminal behavior reported by the 911 caller, and therefore did not have a reasonable suspicion that defendant was involved in a felony or misdemeanor to justify the seizure." And again, the seizure was parking the police car in such a way that it blocked the defendant's vehicle. Next is People v. Duval on page 23. It's another search and seizure case, this one involving a search warrant. The First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Tom, over a two-justice dissent, held that the description in the search warrant of the property to be searched was sufficient, notwithstanding that public records showed three residential units at that street address. The court said, "The only indication that the house legally could have been occupied as separate units was the extrinsic materials supplied by defendant in moving to controvert the warrant, consisting of public records showing that the house contained three units. However, the fact that city records reflected that the house could be occupied as three units for tax and zoning purposes does not require a conclusion that it was. There likely are numerous legal two- or three-family residential houses that remain occupied by single families. The classifications of these houses relate to tax or land use matters that have no necessary bearing on the facial validity of a warrant. Next is People versus Barnes. It's a sentencing case involving ineffective assistance. The Third Department, vacating defendant's sentence, held the Parker warnings were inadequate. Although the error was not preserved for appeal, defense counsel was deemed ineffective for failing to challenge the enhanced sentence. The court wrote, defendant contends that Supreme Court erroneously imposed the enhanced sentence given that it did not specifically inform him as part of the Parker admonishment that a consequence of failing to appear for sentencing was the imposition of a greater sentence. The court wrote, the lack of preservation is attributable to the deficiencies of defendant's trial counsel who represented him both during the plea proceedings and at sentencing. Counsel was ineffective in failing to challenge the enhanced sentence as there was no strategic reason for failing to do so, particularly in light of the clear omissions that were made by Supreme Court in administering the Parker admonishment. In view of this, we excuse the lack of preservation and address the merits. Next is People v. Ferguson on pages 24 and 25. It's another sentencing case, and it also involves an order of protection. The Second Department held the defendant could not be sentenced to probation only for assault, and Supreme Court should not have issued an order of protection in favor of a person who was not a victim or a witness. The court wrote, Penal Law, Section 60.05, Subdivision 5, mandates that a person convicted of a Class D violent felony offense of assault in the second degree be sentenced to a term of imprisonment. Such a sentence could consist of a determinate term of imprisonment of at least 2 years and no more than 7 years, or alternatively, a definite term of imprisonment of 1 year or less under Penal Law Section 70, Subdivision 4, or an intermittent term of imprisonment under Penal Law Section 85. Moreover, a split sentence of imprisonment and probation is also authorized. The defendant, a first-time felony offender, requests that his sentence be equivalent to the amount of time that he has already served in connection with this conviction. Such a sentence would be a legal sentence if the sentencing court, in considering the circumstances of the crime and the defendant's character, deems such a sentence to be proper. But again, probation alone for this violent felony offense of assault in the second degree was not authorized. Next is another People v. Ferguson on pages 25 and 26. It's another sentencing case. This time the issue was redaction of the pre-sentence report. The Fourth Department held defendant in this manslaughter case was entitled to a hearing to determine what information should be redacted from the pre-sentence report. However, she was not entitled to resentencing. The court wrote, the record establishes that defendant sent a letter to county court objecting to certain portions of the report, including references to her failure to cooperate with law enforcement and to her invocation of her right to counsel. At sentencing, the court acknowledged the objections and indicated that it agreed with some but not all of them. The court, however, failed to articulate which portions should be redacted. Accordingly, because defendant was not properly afforded an opportunity to challenge the contents of the pre-sentence report, we hold the case and remit the matter to county court for further proceedings in accordance with our decision. Next is People v. Walton on pages 26 and 27. It's another sentencing case. Here, the defendant was not informed that the sentence would include a period of post-release supervision. The Second Department, vacating defendant's guilty plea, held that the plea was not voluntary because defendant was not informed that the sentence would include a period of post-release supervision. At the time of the plea, defendant was told the 1 to 3.5 year sentence promise was conditioned upon no additional arrests. Defendant was arrested twice before sentencing. The court imposed an enhanced sentence, which included a period of post-release supervision, which was not mentioned at the time of the plea. The error was appealable despite the lack of preservation. The court said, "The record reflects that the defendant was not made aware at the time he entered his plea that the terms of his sentence would include a period of post-release supervision, nor did he have a sufficient opportunity to move to withdraw his plea on that basis before the court imposed sentence. Accordingly, the judgment must be reversed and the plea of guilty vacated." Next is People v. Cleveland on page 27, another sentencing case. The Fourth Department vacated defendant's sentence because the sentencing court did not mention restitution as part of the sentence in defendant's presence. The error survives a lack of preservation and a waiver of appeal. The Fourth Department noted that any discrepancy between the restitution amount in the plea agreement and the amount in the confession of judgment must be remedied upon resentencing. Court wrote, "Defendant contends and the people concede that his confession of judgment with respect to restitution must be voided because the amount thereof differs from the amount of restitution contemplated by the plea bargain. Although not raised by the parties, we conclude that defendant's sentence must be vacated in its entirety because county court failed to pronounce the sentence of restitution in open court. Criminal Procedure Law 380.20 and 380.40 collectively require that courts must pronounce sentence in every case where a conviction is entered, and that subject to limited exceptions not relevant here, the defendant must be personally present at the time sentence is pronounced. Restitution is a component of the sentence to which Criminal Procedure Law 380.20 and 380.40 apply. When the sentencing court fails to orally pronounce a component of the sentence must be vacated and the matter remitted for resentencing in compliance with the statutory scheme." Next is People v. Van Heining on page 28. It's another sentencing case. It just stands for the proposition that the probation sentence here could not legally be 6 years. It could not exceed 5 years. The court wrote, "When a probation violation is sustained and the court continues the sentence, the court may extend the sentence for a period constituting the time from when a defendant is declared delinquent to when a determination is made on such delinquency, which in this case was from September 2016 to September 2017. The record reflects that defendant was originally sentenced to the maximum term of probation of 5 years, and county court continued that sentence. Although the court was authorized to extend the sentence to account for the time between September 2016 and September 2017, by doing so in this case and having defendant's probation end in 2022, it impermissibly expanded the term of probation beyond the statutory maximum. In other words, assuming that defendant served the whole term of probation, he would have been on probation from September 2015 to September 2016, and then again from September 2017 to September 2022, which is 6 years total. Given that the sentence imposed was illegal, the matter must be remitted for resentencing." Next is People v. Tripp on pages 28 and 29, another sentencing case, this time involving consecutive versus concurrent sentences. The Fourth Department determined defendant's sentences should run concurrently, not consecutively, noting that the preservation of the error was not required. The court said, "The sentence is illegal insofar as county court directed that the sentences imposed on the two counts charging criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree run consecutively to the sentence imposed on the count charging assault in the second degree. We note that defendant's contention does not require preservation. The people had the burden of establishing that consecutive sentences were legal, i.e. that the crimes were committed through separate acts or omissions," and that cites Penal Law Section 70.25, Subdivision 2, "and they failed to meet that burden. With respect to the count charging criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree under Penal Law Section 265.03, Subdivision 1B, the people neither alleged nor proved that defendant's possession of the gun was marked by an unlawful intent separate and distinct from his intent to shoot the victim. With respect to the count charging criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree under Penal Law Section 265.03, Subdivision 3, there was no evidence presented at trial that defendant's act of possessing a loaded firearm was separate and distinct from his act of shooting the victim. Therefore, the sentences must run concurrently. Next is People v. Cologne on page 29. It deals with the issue of severance. Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that defendant's, his name is Maldonado, defendant's trial should have been severed from the co-defendant's trial. The court wrote, by seeking to implicate each other, defendant's and Maldonado's defenses were clearly antagonistic, mutually exclusive, and irreconcilable, and created a significant possibility that the jury unjustifiably concluded by virtue of the conflict itself that both defenses were incredible and gave undue weight to the people's evidence. Next is People v. Byund, B-U-Y-U-N-D, on page 30. It's a Sex Offender Registration Act case. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice LaSalle, held that burglary as a sexually motivated felony first degree, Penal Law Section 140.30 Subdivision 2, is not a registerable offense under the Sex Offender Registration Act, the result of an apparently unintended omission from the correction law. Defendant had attempted to rape the victim after breaking into her house. The court noted that a sex offender classification is appealable even when the alleged error is not preserved. The court wrote, burglary in the first degree as a sexually motivated felony is not a registerable sex offense under SORA. While this may not have been the intent of the legislature, the omission of a critical grammatical signpost or a parenthetical number clearly limits the qualifying sexually motivated felony offenses only to those enumerated in subparagraphs 1 and 2. The maxim, expressio unius est exclusio alterius, is applied in the construction of statutes, so that where a law expressly describes a particular act, thing, or person to which it shall apply, an irrefutable inference must be drawn that what is omitted or not included was intended to be omitted or excluded. Next is People v. Fisher on pages 30 and 31. It's another Sex Offender Registration Act case. Second Department, reducing defendant's risk assessment from level 2 to level 1, determined a downward departure was appropriate because the statutory rape conviction involved consensual sex and defendant had no other sexual offenses in his history. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for the attorney affirmation for the November 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE. The verification code is waiver. Again, the verification code for this November 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE is waiver. The last three cases in the pamphlet deal with the waiver of indictment and the use of a superior court information in the place of an indictment. All three of them found that the waiver of indictment was jurisdictionally defective because it didn't include the approximate time of the offense. However, in November of 2019, on November 26th, the Court of Appeals ruled that these kinds of defects are not jurisdictional and are therefore subject to the preservation requirement and some level of factual analysis. The Court of Appeals case is People versus Thomas, 2019 New York Slip Opinion 08545, and it's dated November 26th, 2019.